Snap Studios. The first thing that they want to ask me after they stop staring is how it happened. How did you do that to yourself? At first, I told folk the truth. But when they looked away, I understood that no one cared what I said. They just wanted to hear that it was my fault, that I did something wrong, because if I didn't, if this just happened to me, it could happen to them too. But I could not oblige, because one does not simply grab an axe and cut off their own legs and replace them with metal. It's not done. And after, I remember thinking that getting rid of my arms, that too was a good idea, that metal arms would be far superior. And if metal arms, why not a whole metal torso? Only after I had removed my head and replaced it with a shiny new one fashioned of tin to match the rest of my physique, then went to visit my lady fair and saw the look of horror in her eyes, only then did I realize that I'd been bewitched. But as she screamed and waved her hands about, I understood as well that, well, that I didn't care about her anymore. I wondered why. Perhaps it was because I neglected to get a heart. Perhaps. But I did care. I do care about whomever bewitched me. Because it seems as if they've stolen something from me. Something that I used to treasure. And I want it back. So, I'm going to name this episode after myself. They call me the Tin Man. Snap Judgment proudly presents stories from people trying to find a piece of themselves. Because I have a feeling, can I say that, that I'm not the only one missing something. Do be careful not to veer off a yellow brick road. Terrible things have been known to happen when you're listening to Snap Judgment. Much love to the Tin Man for taking the mic. We do appreciate it. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're going to kick this Snap Judgment episode off, the Tin Man episode. We start down the road from Snap Studios, where our guest, Dr. James Fallon, studied some people who were missing some aspect of themselves. And he spoke to our own Julia DeWitt to tell his story.
A fair number of the cases, because I didn't know going in at all who they were or anything. They were very violent murderers, and some were serial killers.
This is James Fallon.
James Fallon, professor of psychiatry and human behavior, University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. Author of the book called The Psychopath Inside. It has a longer title, but The Psychopath Inside will get you there.
James is a scientist who studies the brains of psychopaths. He lives on a cul-de-sac on the UC Irvine campus. He married his childhood sweetheart. When I got there, he was preparing to go to a hockey game with his son. The people he studies feel a million miles away from here. For legal reasons, James can't reveal any details about the psychopaths, but some of them were famous for how heinous their crimes were. James's job was to get inside the minds of these killers.
I started receiving PET scans from the early 90s, and those included killers who were psychopaths. And so I looked at them and then took notes on what areas of the brain were kind of dysfunctional. Turns out that the psychopaths had this pattern, and I went, oh man, it was like, it was, you know, for a neuroanatomist like me, seeing patterns is everything. And so when I saw that, I said, oh man, there's a pattern. Nobody had ever really talked about it.
Basically, what James saw were these big dark spots in the brain, places where there was little or no activity. These were the areas where things like moral reasoning and impulse control come from. The place where we manage our most base instincts. There are also dark spots where empathy originates. That sad feeling you have when you see someone you love cry. Psychopaths don't get that feeling. James studied these minds for years, piecing together this puzzle, finding patterns. Then one day, James was at his desk in his office.
I was sitting in my office at the medical school, and I was surrounded by piles of printouts, and the printouts were of different types of scans. All these analyses that I've been looking at of murderers.
James had a lab of techs and students working with him on this. And on this day, one of them came to his office with a PET scan. The tech was confused about something. This brain was supposed to basically be a healthy brain. The scan should have been glowing with activity.
And they're colored. They have red and they have blue and they have yellow, they have green, and a buzzer went off. And I went, oh man. And I called in the technician. There were two of them. And I said, this came out of the scanner. It's in the wrong pile. It's obviously one of the murderers here.
The scan he had in his hands had all those big, telltale dark spots on it.
And I told the technicians to check the machine and the provenance of, you know, the data as it got to me. I said, this is obviously from the pile of these murders of psychopaths. It looked exactly like it. It was just a pure case. I said, you got to check this out because somebody's walking around in society probably shouldn't be walking around, potentially a very dangerous person.
James peeled back the scan to find out who this person was.
And I peeled back that last name, and it was my name.
The psychopathic brain belonged to James.
And I was, that's the joke is on me.
James had used himself as a control in another study he was doing about Alzheimer's. His brain was supposed to be one of the normal ones. James's first instinct was to assume the pattern he thought he found was wrong. His brain was normal, so if it had those dark spots, then those dark spots didn't mean what he thought they meant. After all, James was a family man and an esteemed scientist, not a psychopath.
Basic part of being a psychopath is you're a predator on other human beings. And that predation can take different forms. It can be by taking their life or sexually, through rape and abuse and just using people and manipulating them. They can ruin people's lives. And that predation is done without a sense of conscience.
There is no formal diagnosis of psychopath in the DSM. But up until that day in the lab, James was sure he knew one when he saw one.
It's like art and pornography. You know, it's hard to exactly define, but you get a marlin on, you know it's a fish. You got a fish on. And it's like, exactly when do you know? Well, you at some point you know.
Unlike the guys he was studying, James didn't have a criminal record. He had no history of violence, and he certainly hadn't killed anyone.
I told my wife, I said, that's the damnedest thing. I said, I was, looking at these scans, and ours came back, and I said, my scan looked just like one of these psychopathic killers. And she said something that was quite curious, I guess, at the time, even though I just laughed at that, too. She goes, it doesn't surprise me.
While I was interviewing James, his brother Mark walked into the house. So I asked him what he thought of the news that his brother might be a psychopath.
Well, it all started making sense.
To him, it also was no big surprise.
It's a game for him to manipulate a room and a situation. It was a game to him. And if you called him on it, And he would let, you'd see his eyes sparkle, and, you know, he knew that the game had played out. You never get a feeling that he's trying to hurt people. You know, people do get, they do get hurt. And he keeps moving on. And if he hears about it, many times he can justify it, and he can explain it in a way that it sounds justified. But he's just too smart to, if you think you're going to beat him at his game, you know, forget it.
As James continued to poll his friends and family, he started to get feedback he'd never heard before. He was manipulative, they said. He looked out for himself first. If you're crying and you need someone to feel bad with you, James definitely was not your guy. Everyone knew that.
Normally, when I'm hearing tragic stories and seeing terrible things, I'm not hit emotionally with it, but I'm interested in it, you see. It's an academic thing. I just don't feel what others feel, it appears. People just, it's not just a matter of not doing bad things. It's if you don't have the capacity to really give them love that they expect. It's part of it, which I don't. My daughter said the same thing. My wife said the same thing. You ain't there, man. Now, if you look at the picture behind me on the wall, what do you see? There's two people that are painted there. Mm-hmm. There's one over there, and then there's this one. And or one daughter, she painted that many, many years ago. And that's me. And it's this dark character. I mean, look at that thing. See, she's known all along, right?
And the other one is your wife?
And the wife, yeah.
And that one's more of like a, will you describe that one?
Light, well, it's light and bright and is a presence that's very benevolent. This is a demonic character. So there are many things that in retrospect add up to all of this, especially with my older brothers and friends. I put them in lots of harm's way, you know.
One of the best examples of this is when he exposed his brother to a cousin virus of Ebola. Not Mark, that brother we heard from earlier, but another one of his brothers. It's called the Marburg virus. And it's every bit as gross and terrible and tragic as Ebola. James was doing some research in Africa.
I was working at the University of Nairobi Hospital that a guy had come in there just recently, bleeding out from every, you know, his ears and his eyes. And I knew where he got it.
James suspected that it came from the bat dung in a cave on a nearby preserve. When his brother came to town to visit him, James thought, where better to take him than to those caves?
I said, well, let's go on a safari. He said, nobody goes here. And I know nobody goes there because of what happened. And then went to the Kedem Caves, where I thought probably was there in the, you know, bat dung or something in the cave, walls of the caves, is where the virus was latent. Turns out that's true. But I brought him to the caves. We went in there, and it was all these, you know, elephant carcasses, bats, millions of bats all around this. And I just told him, I said, don't touch the ground.
What James did not tell him was that if he did touch the ground, he might die after hemorrhaging from every orifice of his body. Once he got home, James's brother realized where he'd been, and the relationship has never been the same. But when before this didn't mean much to him, now James saw his behavior as psychopathic. So because he was a highly achieving person, the type that when he set goals, he reached them, he set himself a particularly lofty new goal, to be a good guy.
I said, what do I do now? Now I had to deal with myself. I said, okay, if I'm doing this, I said, how do I treat my wife? Because I, you know, she likes half of what I do and the other half she absolutely hates. Every day, all the interactions with her, without letting her know what was going on, I just thought to myself, what would a good guy do here? It could be who gets to pour the wine first, but also, do I go to her aunt's funeral? You know, and after about a month of this and 2 months of this, I found out about hundreds of times a day I was doing the interactions. I was doing the most selfish thing possible.
James's wife was surprised and happy to see her longtime husband doing nicer things. And she didn't even really care that he was just faking it. But while she was loving his new generosity and selflessness, James wasn't having nearly so much fun.
it just slowed me down. I wasn't so glib or smart or like da-da-da-da-da-da because I was thinking of this. When I actually thought, you know, how am I affecting this other person? And it was exhausting. And I said, well, not just be exhausting, be like a regular nice guy. And I was, you know, it's absolutely exhausting.
Are you still doing the good guy thing
now? I'm trying. Yeah, I try. I slip up every once in a while. I do. But I'm still trying. I got to, you know, write myself. Okay. But absolutely exhausting.
While I listened to James talk, I felt an unexpected feeling come over me. That feeling was jealousy. Because here's the thing about being someone like James. Manipulating situations to come out to your benefit or for your own entertainment, not caring about people's feelings, it may seem kind of monstrous, but caring, it's true, it takes up a lot of time and energy. Imagine for a second if you didn't care about your boss's disapproval. If someone's expecting you home tonight, what if his or her disappointment didn't scathe you? What would you do instead? You would do whatever you wanted, that's what. And if someone got mad at you, well, you wouldn't care about that either. But still, most of us, we do care because we have no other choice. James, on the other hand, can choose.
And I, in talking to this one psychiatrist, he goes, this is the problem. You don't care. You really, really don't care. You know what you are and you don't care. It's not a problem. I said, yeah, I really don't. At the end, I just didn't care. Maybe to some people it would seem this seems absurd, right?
I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around the experience of hearing that and then getting to know it and also knowing, you know, people saying that you're not there and especially the narcissism. Like, for example, I got worried that I was a narcissist the other day, so I went and took a narcissism test online. I scored very low. It's like it was a very stupid test. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, I was just like, what if I'm selfish? And that was really scary to me.
I mean, maybe that's what people do. Regular people, they think, what am I doing now? Is this going to hurt this other person's feelings? I don't think about that.
James continues to try to emulate generosity and kindness today. And at least when it comes to the small things, he's pretty successful at it. But he has a line in the sand that he will draw if the time ever comes. If ever making other people happy makes him less happy, that's it. The good guy game is over. He may try to do the right thing, but at the end of the day, there's no cure for psychopathy.
A long-term colleague of mine, who I was very close to for many, many years, had a memorial, and it's a Saturday, and you have a choice between sitting there in a suit, coat, and tie, and listening to a bunch of talks about somebody who's dead, okay? I just went down to Blackie's Bar down in Newport Beach and had a couple of beers and watched some sports. But I said, the hell with it. You know, I'm not going to do it. I'll just do something else. And I'm smiling like I'm really happy about this, but it's just, I think it's so funny because it's just like, why? That's who you are. It was just too much work on a hot day to do the right thing. And so I went down where there was air conditioning, you know, and a couple of beers.
Dr. James Fallon. He's written a book about his own experience as well as the science of the psychopathic mind. If you didn't catch the name earlier, it's called The Psychopath Inside. I'm going to have a link at snapjudgment.org. The original score for that piece was created by Leon Morimoto and was produced by Julia DeWitt. Now, later in the show, what is it like to see everything while seeing nothing at all? And grabbing at your lost self on the other side of a wall. When Snap Judgment, the 10-man episode, continues, stay tuned. Snap Judgment is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at progressive.com.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the 10-man episode. Today, we're featuring stories from people looking for a missing part of themselves. But what if you don't know that you're missing anything? Our own Nancy Lopez spoke to Tom Contis to find out his story.
I live in the middle of nowhere. I rarely see my neighbors, and other than the neighbors that I see that I know, everybody else to me is a stranger. I'm ecstatic.
A few years ago, Tom and his wife sold their home in LA, jumped into their RV with their two dogs, and never looked back. They crisscrossed the country three times over and landed on a 13-acre farm in Kentucky, their new home. They raise chickens and cows. They're starting their own organic farm. It's a quiet place. The view from their front porch is breathtaking. Endless rolling hills of luscious green pasture.
I'm not living with this fear sitting on my shoulder. I am more relaxed. I am more at peace. So I'm like Howard Hughes. I'm a hermit.
Tom embraces the isolation. It means he doesn't have to deal with anybody. As far back as he can remember, he's always stumbled through his interactions with people, be they strangers or loved ones, coworkers or acquaintances, never quite grasping what he was missing out on.
I think it was difficult to attach myself to people. I think it was difficult for people to attach themselves to me. You know, I'm different. I've always known I was different. I never knew why or how. I don't know. I felt like I wanted to go hide in a closet or hide under a rock.
The only ones he never had trouble connecting with were his kids.
My son was my world. Came before me and came before anything. So did my daughter when she was born. She wasn't as skinny as Peter was. She wasn't as long and skinny, but she was little and she fit in my hand too. I didn't have time to worry about whether I fit or whether I didn't or whether I was this or whether somebody liked me. In the early 20s with two children, you know, I did the best I could with what I had.
But as easy as it was with his kids, it was impossible with his first wife. So the day before Christmas in 1975, Tom moved out. Then his wife moved to a different state to be with her new boyfriend and took the kids with her.
There was a good period of time where the only way that I could speak to my son was to call the school that he attended. And the principal at the school would bring him into the office and I could talk to him on the phone. And
that worked for a while. But then during one phone call with his son, Tom learned that his wife's new boyfriend was mistreating his children.
Still committed to my children. I had a lawyer and we were going through a divorce and I asked for custody because I saw that they were in danger. And it was during that time that this incident occurred. In legal strategy, I had asked that there be psychiatric evaluations of both parents of these children and their stepfather, because their stepfather, I was certain, was, you know, off of his rocker and was abusing my ex and my children. They agreed to the evaluations, and when it came time for those evaluations, I think I went first.
Tom went to the doctor's office. He didn't want to run into his ex-wife and her boyfriend, but he was looking forward to seeing his kids that day.
I'm sitting in the doctor's little exam room waiting for the doctor to come in, and the door was open, and there was a hallway, and there was a little blonde girl that was leaning against the wall, and she was crying. That's my daughter. She's crying. I have to help her. You know, and she's there, and she's got her head in her arm, and she had on a little dress. I picked her up and I hugged her, put her on my lap. She also urinated on me. Yeah, it was a very emotional moment for me. It's my daughter. I haven't seen her in 3 months, and she's crying. Oh my God, I've got to take care of her. told her everything's okay, it's going to be okay. The doctor came in and said, you know, let the kid go. I said, it's my daughter. Let the child go. I said, it's my daughter. He says, that's not your daughter. And I think at that point I pushed her back and I looked at her. I think I was probably as shocked as the doctor was. He probably asked me to explain it, and I probably couldn't offer an explanation that was reasonable to him. I couldn't offer an explanation that was reasonable to me. You know, how does a father not recognize his child? You know, how do you pick up somebody else's kid and believe it to be yours and then have a doctor, a psychiatrist of all people, say, that's not your kid? I never saw my daughter that day. Found out that the stepfather didn't come for the evaluation. So my plan, as it was, to have him evaluated to protect my children didn't work anyway. The report from the doctor, you know, was several pages long, but the conclusion of the report was he questioned my psychological attachment to my children, period. The handwriting was on the wall. I wasn't going to get custody, not in that day and age. I messed it up. I never got past the embarrassment. I don't think I even told my best friends. Embarrassed? Beyond embarrassed. Ashamed. You know, how could I fail my children? I've always tried to figure out what happened. It's just, there was never an answer.
Tom moved to California, where things took a turn for the better. His ex-wife called him with some good news. She'd left her boyfriend.
My kids were coming to live with me for the whole summer. They were leaving Oklahoma. They were coming to stay with their dad in Southern California. It was awesome. And my son came to live with me full time. And my daughter stayed living with my ex. I don't know what the logic behind her decision was. I was grateful. I was happy to have my son.
Tom was working as an insurance adjuster. He loved it. He could simply focus on the details of a car accident. When, where, how did it happen, what's the damage? Most of his interaction with people was over the phone. But every so often, he would suffer a social faux pas. Like the time he was a speaker at an auto theft conference. He walked right past a police officer he'd worked with, as if he didn't know him.
Oh my God, that was investigator so-and-so from this agency, and we were working on this identity theft case, and it was a big case, and it involved a whole lot of people, and I just looked like an idiot. I think it caused fear. It was a latent fear. I didn't know it was there, but I would be guarded in putting myself in positions like that.
Then Tom met Lorraine.
I was working at the Holiday Inn near the Los Angeles airport. He came in and had dinner, and I was his server.
She was cute.
Yes. I think he only recognized me because there was only three servers, and I was the only girl. The other two were guys. We talked a little bit, and we made arrangements to go out the next night, and we've been together ever since.
One Sunday night, when Tom was a couple of years into retirement, he and Lorraine were home, sitting in front of the TV.
And 60 Minutes was on television. They were showing these people who were unable to recognize and identify their spouses or their children. They just didn't know who those people were.
The show was about a mysterious condition called prosopagnosia. It's about people who cannot recognize faces. It's not a problem with their vision. It has to do with how their brain is wired. Everything else functions fine except their ability to process a face. So it's hard to form meaningful relationships. Hearing this struck a chord with Tom.
And it was like a light bulb went off.
For you?
Yeah, for me too.
So they reached out to one of the researchers, who gave Tom a series of tests and came back to him with the diagnosis.
I'm face blind. This is a stupid analogy, but it's almost like finding out that the aliens had come down and captured me and they were pulling the strings on my life, and I was living a life that wasn't real. You know, my view of the world didn't match the reality of the world.
So, yeah, after seeing the show, it explained a ton about why he didn't know people. I think we went to go meet his sister for dinner someplace, and we walked into the restaurant, and I was walking right toward her, and he kept asking me where she was. And I said, she's right in front of you. Granted, he hadn't seen his sister in a while, but I always kind of wondered, you know, how do you not recognize your own sister? You know, even when we're in a store, he doesn't always recognize me.
Really?
Yeah. We've been in Costco, and I've been like, hello.
And he sometimes sees you.
And he'll look over, and he'll be like, oh. Yeah, it takes him a minute.
When I received the diagnosis and I discovered it, initially it was, I would say, almost euphoric. You know, I had an answer to how I misidentified my daughter.
Do you feel it almost absolved you of whatever guilt you carried about it?
Maybe. The truth is, I failed. I didn't do the right thing, did I? I didn't identify that girl. That's a failure. I actually sent a letter to my ex-wife, my children, and my sister, apologizing.
For?
Being the way I was. You know, I always wanted inclusion, but my behavior was exactly the opposite. It pushed people away, and I wouldn't let anybody close enough to be included.
His daughter's response to the letter was short and sweet.
She's awesome. She says, don't be so hard on yourself. I never got past the embarrassment. Till we talked, my daughter never knew. Now she knows.
How long have you guys been together now?
We'll be 27 years this year.
Lorraine knows Tom's idiosyncrasies probably better than anyone. And now she knows why they can't watch a movie together.
You know, actually, he will watch a Bruce Willis movie because it's Bruce Willis. He can focus on Bruce Willis. He looks the same. He never changes his shirt. It's always bloody and ripped.
You know, bald.
Yeah, bald. It's easy. Yeah, especially he doesn't have to worry about a change in hairstyle.
It took Tom 11 years to propose to Lorraine. He figured he'd wake up one day and she'd be gone. But he got lucky.
Here we are. No, still here. Still telling you who people are.
He says that I'm nicer now.
He's actually much easier to get along with. Now. Yeah. Because he has a better understanding of who and what he was and who and what he is now. And it's given us an explanation. So I'm more prepared when we're in a social setting. You know, more prepared if we go to Costco or go to the market. I don't change my hairstyle in the meat department, so he knows who I am. Or take my coat off. You know, I keep an eye out for him.
A very big thank you to Tom Constance and his wife, Lorraine, for sharing their story. And a big shout out as well to Brad Duchesne, the researcher who helped Tom with his diagnosis. The original soundscape for that story was created by Renzo Gorio, and the piece was produced by Nancy Lopez. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, we pull apart the most powerful bond of all and see if it breaks. When Snap Judgment, the 10-man episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the 10-man episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're asking people with a missing piece to tell us what happened. And for our next story, we go back in Korean history, but start out at the dinner table. Mary Kim is eating dinner with her father, Jin Kil, when he reveals a dark family secret.
When I was 12, as he was chewing into some roasted mackerel, suddenly his eyes began to well with tears. He said, "My sister, this was her favorite kind of fish." He took a bite of mackerel, and he said, "Pook." She disappeared when I was 14. I was stunned. Here was a ghost in our family. After he told me about her at dinner, he would include her during his very solemn and long Thanksgiving prayers, the sister that he so loved. It wasn't until much later that I realized that the reason why he'd never told us about her before was that she was North Korean. Many decades ago, when Korea was still unified as one country, my grandfather couldn't afford to send both his eldest children to school, and so chose his eldest born son. That meant that Bo-ok was sent to teacher education program in a remote country village. And she was not satisfied with that at all because she was number one in her class. Instead, she chose to go north, where education opportunities were freer at the time for women. And then the Korean War happened. My father never saw her again. Then in 2005, the Red Cross offered my father, Jin Gil, the chance to see his sister, Bo-ok, for the first time in more than 55 years. Not in person, but via webcam. They would set up a video chat, like Skype, with North Korea on one side and South on the other. My father took his family members to a cramped hotel room in Seoul in South Korea. In the room was a video camera and a large screen. The family sat down and waited, making nervous conversation. He pulled out his letter. He spent months writing, organizing, and preparing his 6-page letter that recounted everything he ever wanted to say. I had no idea how she might appear. I expected to see a living skeleton because of North Korea's tendency to starve its own people. The screen flickers and the connection establishes. Then Bo-ok's face and that of our northern relatives, we see them.
Nuna, 나 진길입니다.
어, 진길이가?
예, 나 진길이고 연옥이고.
Sister, this is Jingil.
Jingil, is that really you?
Yes.
Good to see you. It's been so long.
Surprisingly, her cheeks were full. I noticed that she seemed to have a little bit of makeup on and had a lovely traditional garment on with silver beading, which must have been expensive, unusual.
In preparation to see you, I wrote your letter. I'll read it first.
Nuna.
And then he launches into one of his oldest memories of her.
I don't know if you remember, but one winter night, we had a fight. So Dad punished you by making you stand outside in the freezing cold. I felt sorry for you, so I tried to go outside. But Mom and Dad wouldn't let me. So I told them I had to pee. I remember how we were freezing together in the cold. I felt sorry about that. After you went to North Korea, I didn't realize that when we lived together, I never told you that I love you. That broke my heart.
내가 한 번도 누나를 좋아한다는 얘기도 못했고 그래서 늘 마음이 아팠습니다.
and could barely speak. My father is not an emotional man. Until I was 18, he never told me that he loved me. On the southern side, of course, our shoulders were shaking. On the northern side, she was amused. It was a kind of slightly mocking, as if, look at what's become of you. That soft southern living. A traditional Korean man would never have said that. My dad noticed that, but kept on reading.
But even now, when I see high school students with ponytails in her hair, I am reminded of you. I find myself looking at those kids as if they were you. My memories are frozen at the time we last say goodbye.
When you spoke about searching for that ponytailed girl, I understood my father in a way I hadn't before. What it must have been like for him to have 4 daughters, and why he so insisted that we all get the best education we could. He wanted to give me what his own family never gave her.
어머니 아버지가 자꾸 돌아오시겠다고 그렇게 그래가지고.
About 20 years after you left, I went to the U.S. I took a mom and dad with me and take care of them. But they keep on wanting me go back to Korea. Deep down inside, they must have thought you would escape North Korea and return home one day. Mom cried every night.
He reveals to her that he has 4 daughters, an only daughter. She jokes, rich in daughters, and everyone laughs. And then she reveals that she herself has 3 daughters and 2 sons.
But you need sons, not daughters. You need sons to protect the country and reunite Korea.
Soon, my father's grand filibuster ended. Finally, his sister Bo-ok was given a chance to speak.
Well, younger brother, let me tell you about my life. I remember we were so dirt poor.
She spends the next only 15 minutes to my father's hour and 15 minutes to recount what has occurred in the past 55 years for her.
Then the Korean War broke out. The American bastards came to Korea and killed our soldiers in the streets. So I became a volunteer soldier and took care of injured.
She started speaking about how the American bombs fell and took her leg.
I was so upset about that. Remember, I used to be the fastest runner in school. But then our great leader said, "Don't cry. The American bastards are the problem, not your leg."
Then she married a man, and then more bombs fell from the American side, and then he lost both his legs.
But I made a family to him and gave birth 5 children. You wouldn't be able to imagine what it's like for cripples to raise a family. One time I woke up to find my first son with a severe virus, almost about to die. But my husband and I couldn't run him to the hospital. So our neighbor carried our son on his back like a horse and ran him to the hospital during the middle of the night. When our great leaders heard of our sick son, they ran over to the hospital and told the doctors, "You need to help him survive. You need to help him. Once our nation is unified, he needs to take his parents back to their hometown." I was so moved. Such a good life in this socialist community wouldn't exist in a capitalist nation.
이런 현상은 아마 자본주의 살지 수 없을 거야.
I couldn't tell if she was believing her own words. I looked to her eldest son, and unlike his mother's plump cheeks, his cheeks were cliff-like hollows.
I'm only alive today because our great leader's love and support. I got everything in life I ever wanted.
아니겠는... The amount of swabbing and sweating that her eldest son was doing seemed to contradict her words.
We don't have many years left now. All I want is to see our country unified.
Yes, I believe that they will be here soon.
Yes, I do too. But we need to kick out the American bastards. We need to kick them.
He held his tongue, and he listened to her.
Can finally meet and live happily together.
Yeah.
She pauses for a moment, and my father clears his throat and suggests, let's sing a song together.
Yes, what should we sing?
Do you know, We Are One?
It's one of the many anthems blending both the national anthems of both Koreas. Both North Korean and South Korean family members sang together in unison. My father, still full of tears, took up the words. Our hope is for one country. We pray, even in dreams. The song began to come to its end. They were given a signal that their meeting was about to end. While they were singing, the screen darkened. My aunt's face disappears. It's been 10 years since that reunion. Thanksgivings are smaller now. My father's prayers are quieter now. His prayers are shorter. He prays for our family. But he never mentions her. No. I mention her. I ask him about whether or not she's still alive. He doesn't say. He lets a pause hang between us. He's very resigned that he will never see her again, that she is dead. It's me who hopes that, who still harbors hope that she's alive. Po-ok.
Thanks so much to Mary Kim for sharing your father's story. Mary Kim is a poet, a writer, and a professor at the Savannah College of Art and Design. We'll have a link to some of her work on our website, snapjudgment.org. Special thanks as well, Yong Nam and Mikyong Kim, for being the voice actors for Chin Kyo and Bo Ok. The original score for that piece was by Davey Kim. It was produced as well by Davey Kim. Oh yeah, Snappers, it's that time. Subscribe now to the Snap Storytelling Podcast. It's all there at snapjudgment.org, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, on Facebook, on Twitter. And know that Snap was produced by a team that is not in Kansas anymore. Who's that behind the curtain? The great and powerful Oz himself, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Starring Patton C.D. Miller as the Scarecrow, Julia DeWitt as Dorothy, Anna the Good Witch Sussman, Nancy of the North Lopez, Davy the Cowardly Lion Kim, the Gatekeeper Renzel Gorio, Joe Auntie M. Rosenberg, our Flying Minions, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, Teo Ducat, Jasmine, she's no Oompa Loompa Aguilera. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you and your little dog get sucked into a tornado, spin round and round, land right on top of Dumbledore as he officiates a Quidditch match, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is PRN.